party. Tickets and information can be found at mspfilm.org or find the Minnesota Cuban Film Festival page on Facebook.
The viewpoints expressed in this program are the opinions of the people expressing them, and not necessarily those of Fresh Air Incorporated, its staff, or its board of directors.
You are listening to Fresh Air Community Radio, KFAI 90.3 FM, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and around the world at kfai.org. Non-commercial, community-powered radio. Thursdays at this time, it's the Northern Sun Radio News with Don Olson and Dave Rudnick, and we'll be having Greg Clavey from the Minnesota Cuba Committee. Will be talking about Cuba. Welcome to KFEI, Northern Sun News.
Thank you, Don.
So Monday night, our wannabe king declared that Cuba was a failed country, and he'd be happy to intervene in Cuba if necessary. I know you have a bit of a difference. You had a very nice interview with Al McFarland on The Conversation on Tuesday, but why don't you talk about it's a lot of stressors these days for the country of Cuba and people who want to have a fair and just world.
Yeah, I think there is a lot of points of change that are happening across the world that's connected directly to Minnesota. It's not a surprise to me that while Cuba is on the international stage, it's sharing that international stage with Minnesota. And I think, why is this? Why is there so much focus over a country which, as Mr. Trump says, has no money, has no oil, has no whatever, food? He's rather blatant about the actuality of U.S. foreign policy toward Cuba for over 60 years, in that it's meant to starve and deprive and choke the Cuban economy so that the people will suffer and, as they plan it, hideously rise up and throw out their government. But I want to point out what's at stake here is that Cuba has never been merely Cuba itself. The fate of the Cuban Revolution is inseparable from the broader historical contest between domination and emancipation, between empire and sovereignty, between a world ordered by profit and power, and one grounded in human need and collective dignity. And I think that speaks directly to the people of Minnesota and Minneapolis, and why it speaks to the rest of the world is because the people in here, just like the people in Cuba, have experienced the domination of U.S. foreign policy. It's trying to defeat them. It's trying to beat them. And they want to be free of it. They don't want to bend the knee to it. They don't want to kneel to it. Just like the people of Minnesota did not want to bend the knee to the thuggery of the Trump administration in sending agents to Minnesota to arrest our neighbors, the people that work with us and that work to create a monetary fund that the state uses to supply for education, health care, environmental protection. We are beginning to see that profit is directing our economy in the wrong direction, where a few people at the top grow richer at the expense of all of our workers. You know, from its inception, the Cuban Revolution represented a rupture in the global hegemonic order of imperialism, which we now call rules-based order. It is not what was created by the United Nations after World War II to prevent conflict, but a new imperialism with the same violence and the stealing of resources, land, and the wealth of working people. And I think, again, we see that in the streets of Minneapolis with ICE and the Border Patrol. The violence, as they steal our workers, as they steal our right to control our own economy, it's a crime against Cuba. It's a crime against Minnesota. And that's why, just like President Maduro, President Díaz-Canel, the United States has called them authoritarian, dictators. Just like the Trump administration and his lackeys have called Governor Walz, Attorney General Ellison, and the mayors of Minneapolis and St. Paul the same kind of names to degrade them and to try to turn their own people against them. This relentless hostility directed at Cuba for over six decades by economic warfare, political isolation, sabotage, terrorism, military assaults, invasions, and ideological assaults cannot be understood as a response to Cuba's so-called threat to the U.S. national security. Oh, let me correct that. An extraordinary threat to the national security of the United States. Are you kidding? This is when people begin to break the bonds of propaganda. The propaganda that they've been educated to accept. It would be obvious to anybody with two eyes, with two ears, and a mouth that it is totally absurd that Cuba is a threat to the national security, an extraordinary threat to the national security of the United States. It really is aimed as a warning to all those countries in the global south or east or north of the price of disobedience to the rules-based order. But, so, what's the threat? What Cuba represents is a better, more humane world, that a better, more humane world is possible. A world devoted to human rights of health care, education, food, housing, culture, and environmental protection. All these rights are written into their constitution. The right to chart its own path, control its own resources, and prioritize social justice over foreign interests. So that is the threat. Because in this country, you can only get those things through the price of money. It's a privilege, not a right. Even though the majority of Americans believe that all those are rights and rights that the U.S. government needs to respond to. That's why you see the ratings for the administration so low maybe as low as they've been in decades, but also almost no support for Congress, except for maybe, I would say, there is one person that I admire. There's a few, but one person I admire is Ilhan Omar. And she has been one person that has stood out for justice and peace, and who, of course, we see in the media is being attacked the most. So the people need to realize out there that if somebody is being attacked by our administration, the media, our legacy media, that they must be doing something right. They must be working for the people.
Ilhan Omar, of course, just to call it out, that she is the elected representative in the U.S. Congress from Minneapolis and the surrounding suburbs. And she is she's had many people who wanted to overcome her re-elections, but no amount of money seems to have made that much difference, because people have responded, and she has now been taking very strong stands now against ICE, as you were saying.
Yeah. Yeah, she's outspoken against ICE. She's been outspoken against the blockade of Cuba. She's called for the oil blockade to be lifted that Cuba's under now. I mean, imagine the United States made Cuba dependent on oil for its energy needs. When the revolution triumphed in 1959, they were left with an energy system that was totally dependent, running on oil. Because of the blockade, they were not able to get the type of equipment to make that more diverse. Not until just in the past decade have they been able to obtain, through their relations with China and some European countries, as well as Russia, to get alternative means of energy. But I think also that when we talk about Cuba, the allegation is, oh, they don't have freedom and they don't have democracy. But I would beg to differ, that the freedom to have universal health care for everyone, the freedom of education for everyone to master's degree, the freedom to have the ability to create their resources for food, for housing, and how that housing is directed for to the people at the bottom and not at the top, to protect the environment. You're going to see, you know, anybody that's been to Cuba is going to see a beautiful country. And one of the greatest resources they have is the sea that surrounds them. And because of that protection, they are one of the premier sites for scuba diving and snorkeling in the world. A place where the reefs are not declining, but are flourishing. But also, its socialist democracy is an example to those countries trying to move from underdevelopment to independence and sustainability. I just want to explain briefly how their democracy works, because people have a false idea that it's controlled by one party. And that party is not like the parties that we have that are controlled by the rich and powerful. And I'm speaking of the Republican and the Democratic parties. The people at the local municipal level choose their candidates from a list of who is known for their work to grow and protect their neighborhoods. These are people they know and trust, not somebody who has slick advertisements or can pay off people to vote for them. At that municipal level, all the municipal elected office holders are elected, from their knowledge, they will elect others in the other municipalities to represent their province, like, say, the wards of Minneapolis would join with the counties of Minnesota to elect their own representatives for the state of Minnesota. But not only that, but added to those representation are representatives from women's organizations, student organizations down to the age of 16, farmers and labor organizations, so that a broad spectrum of people are involved in the legislative decision-making process, not just the rich and powerful or who people know, lawyers, doctors, etc. They then repeat this process to elect their Congress, the National Assembly. They then choose the cabinet, and which is what they call the Council of State, which then chooses the president and the vice presidents. This process is then ratified by a vote of the people. This is known as a constitutional democracy, with an overwhelming adherence to the Constitution, something that the elected representatives give an oath to, but they rarely, when they pass laws, follow the Constitution. Most of the laws that are being proposed today are exact opposite of the Constitution and have to go to court. The other thing is that this Constitution is debated and amended every 25 to 30 years to keep up with the evolution of society. It's a constitutional debate that starts at the school, every neighborhood, every workplace, and they discuss the issues that need to be addressed. There will be proposals from both the National Assembly and the President and Council of State as to what are the top issues. They get to say what is deleted, and they get to add what is amended. This process goes over a number of times, like a half a dozen times, before they come to a final agreement on the Constitution. Tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of people are involved in this. And it is then voted on. The last Constitution was best known for its family code, where they ratified same-sex marriage, same-sex family code, a protection of children in the family, a protection of senior citizens all through their life is guaranteed. But its very survival has demonstrated that alternatives are possible to capitalism and liberal democracy, that the rule of capital and empire are not the natural progression of humanity. I think that, yeah, that this speaks a lot to the people of Minnesota.
Yeah, we're not really in a position to lecture other countries about democracy anyway. We should be learning open-minded about the things that Greg's talking about in Cuba and in other countries. But instead, of course, we have this imperial arrogance. Cuba is one of the long line of instances of U.S. denial of sovereignty, and its imperial behavior, you know, manifested in Guatemala, Chile, Venezuela, Cuba, and elsewhere. When these countries assert national sovereignty, especially over their own resources, that's cause for war in our eyes. So when Trump talks about a failed country, he should be looking at the United States. There's lots of signs of failure. I would come up Cedar Avenue, and there's homeless encampments under the bridges and stuff. This is a failed country, not Cuba. The reason Cuba's having trouble is because of these six decades of illegal, cruel sanctions, which every year The majority of the world, except for the U.S. and Israel and a handful of countries, condemns our sanctions on Cuba as illegal and a violation of international law, and they're simply cruel. So I think it's, as Greg said, we cannot tolerate a different kind of example about how to take care of a society. And so that's why we're doing it. Yeah. The Don Rowe Doctrine, I consider the Mafia Don Doctrine, that is characterized by bullying, bribes, blackmail, and bombs.
Yeah, violence and thuggery, thievery. And I think definitely Minnesota has put its foot down and said no more. Right now, I think the rest of the world is deciding what they're going to do with the threat of overwhelming military force that the United States has its finger on right now and is willing to use it on whomever they want, whether it's foes, so-called foes, whether it's allies, or it's their own people.
And this kind of aggressive behavior has been reinforced deeply since World War II by the exorbitant privilege of the dollar in international trade. And it's enabled us to willfully, illegally impose severe sanctions on hundreds, probably thousands of individuals, corporations, and countries around the world. And I want to draw people's attention to this again, as I have on prior shows, because these sanctions are extremely deadly in their impacts, and we've been doing this for many years, again, not sanctioned by the United Nations, which is where sanctions are supposed to be debated and upheld or not. And The Lancet, a globally well-known medical journal, publishes occasional special reports besides their regular quarterly, and they did a Lancet Global Health publication about a year and a half ago about sanctions, and it says they caused an estimated 564,000 deaths, mostly children, per year. And this has been going on for 30 years at the cost of 17 million lives. This is U.S. sanctions, which are cruel, immoral, and illegal. And so Cuba's just one close-at-hand example of what the kind of behavior of the United States in its imperial arrogance is pursuing around the world, and it's causing lots and lots of death all the time.
Yeah, and, it's sanctioned over 30 countries, and it's very rarely is anybody else joining in on the sanctions, maybe some other white countries in Europe, but that's very rarely. But these sanctions are basically sanctions by the U.S. government. And as David pointed out, they control the financial, commercial, and economic apparatus of the world because of agreements that were made after World War II. And countries are pretty much fed up with that. And they want to make a different order, one that's more based on human needs, social justice, protecting the environment. It brings me to mind that Cuba right now is going through a deep crisis. Without energy, without electricity, they will not be able to run their hospitals. They will not be able to run clean water supplies. They will not be able to get rid of waste sewage and garbage in the streets. And those are the breeding grounds for disease and for also the deaths of the most susceptible, the prenatal, the embryos that are not born yet, the most the youngest of infants, the oldest of people, emergencies that happen, those people will be fatalities when they could have been saved by a healthcare system that's it's been noted across even Europe as the most efficient healthcare system in the world for the amount of money that they have, with levels of prenatal and maternal mortality and lifespan higher than the United States in the area of developed countries of Europe. And not only has they developed that system for themselves, but they've trained tens of thousands of doctors from over 150 countries across the world. They've trained doctors in Cuba free of charge to go back to their countries. And they've sent doctors to countries around the world that have had earthquakes, floods, tidal waves, infestations, epidemics. During COVID, they sent doctors over 40 nations, including some European nations. So right now, it's really up to the world. We even have doctors, hundreds of doctors in the United States.
That's right.
From poor communities, people who couldn't afford to be doctors here in this country were given free education to become doctors in Cuba at the ELAM, the medical school of the Americas. And they are now one of the most highly recognized doctors in the United States because of that training.
When the United States picked up the president and vice president of Venezuela and took him back to the U.S. on some charges, didn't they force the Cubans to withdraw all their doctors from Venezuela?
That is one of the conditions of the U.S. Now dictating terms to Venezuela under the gun. Under the gun, they've threatened Venezuela. They've threatened the leadership of Venezuela with death, with apprehension. We've seen what they've done to the country in just one swift sweep. They've bombed civilian areas as well as military areas. Cuba had thousands of doctors, and they're still there. And it was that service to the Venezuelan government and people that then was the payment that allowed Venezuela to send oil to them. They were like trading services. Let me point out that Cuba also had some security people there to help prevent the type of operations of the CIA and the State Department and USAID and the National Endowment for Democracy from upsetting their social order. And those people in the abduction of Celia and Nicolas Maduro, they were actually singled out and murdered by the U.S. commando forces, some of them in their sleep.
Now, the Venezuelan oil is a critical piece there, and that's been cut off now. And the U.S., with its imperial and power, both financial and military, makes people back down. Canada could sell oil to Cuba, but it doesn't go against the U.S. Mexico looks like it's giving in under threat of sanctions, so it has been supplying oil. It's supplying other humanitarian things, but it's cut off the oil. My hope is that Russia will have the nerve, the backbone, as it were, to accompany the oil ships right to the Havana Harbor and so rescue Cuba, because modern economies can't run it. There's no diesel.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that brings us to the question of how Cuba will survive. And I want to point out the world owes a debt to Cuba.
Right on.
The world owes a debt to Cuba. Cuba came in and was the spark that started the liberation of African countries from their colonial rulers. They were, when Angola was threatened to be overrun by the apartheid South African army, white army, when Namibia was occupied, when South Africa and was under apartheid, and Mozambique and Zimbabwe were under attack, it was Cuba, only Cuba, that sent military forces as well as doctors and nurses to not only beat back the South African army, but then cause the liberation of those countries involved, as well as overthrow the apartheid system. And where was the first place that Nelson Mandela came to after he was elected president of South Africa? Cuba, to thank Fidel and the Cuban people for their effort and for the lives lost. And I think that Cuba has a pride, and that the countries right now are negotiating amongst themselves as to how they are going to help Cuba. And in fact, the Cuban foreign minister, Bruno Rodriguez, is in Moscow right now. And they're discussing that very thing of how to get Russian oil to Cuba harbors. But again, it asks the question, how will Cuba survive? In 1991, amid the collapse of the socialist bloc and the Soviet Union and the so-called declaration of the end of history, Cuba lost 2/3, or actually 80% of its economy. They went into a special period, it was called. But in that special period, they came up with a plan called Operation Zero. In that plan, they organized society so that everybody helped each other and everybody got together to do what was needed to get things done. And they survived that special period. In fact, they came out of it, and they, at the late 1990s and at the turn of the 21st century, they began to prosper and grow their GDP. And that was right about the time that the Bush administration came in and sanctioned and increased sanctions on Cuba and began to go after those very areas like tourism, their healthcare industry, where they would have their doctors go on missions to other countries to help those countries set up healthcare systems like theirs in their countries. Some countries that had money paid Cuba. It was a big resource of money. Some countries that didn't have the money didn't have to pay. Maybe they gave them some oil or some things like that. But now it's time for all those countries to come to the aid of Cuba. So that Operation Zero is now being implemented in Cuba. They're calling it the War of the People. And they now have technology helping them. China sent 92 solar farms. About 30 of them or more have been installed in the provinces across the country. Now they're in a race to set up 92 more. Now people in the United States are raising money to send more solar panels. We see businesses starting up in the provincial towns, especially Havana, setting up solar panels for people that can afford it, or for in institutions that need it, like hospitals, clinics, places of education, and institutions that are needed to keep the system running. So I think that when the United States invaded Cuba during the Bay of Pigs, like when they threatened to invade Cuba with U.S. forces, and Cuba asked the Soviet Union to arm them with nuclear missiles to fend that off, like when the Cuban people devoted their lives to liberating Africa, and again during this latest loss of life in Venezuela as a result of this U.S. invasion, 32 Cubans lost their lives. This has solidified the country, and you see rallies and determination of the Cuban people to withstand this latest assault. But they're going to need the help of the people. But I just want to say that back during that special period, Fidel offered a stark assessment of the moment. Now, internationalism means defending and preserving the Cuban revolution. To defend this land, this trench, this bastion of socialism, is the greatest service we can offer to humanity. This was not rhetorical flourish. It was strategic and moral diagnosis of a new global realignment that is being obstructed by the powers of profit, violence, thievery, and thuggery. He went on to say, "We understand what it would mean for all progressive forces, for all revolutionary forces, for all lovers of peace and justice in the world, if the United States government succeeded in crushing the Cuban Revolution, and because of this, we consider defending the revolution along with you, our supporters, our compañeros, to be the most sacred duty, even at the cost of sacrifice."
So it's
even at the cost of death. And I'm going to come back, Minnesota, to Renee Nicole Good and Alex Preddy. These were our martyrs. We should not forget them. They lost their lives struggling for peace and justice. We know that, and we have to step up, not only to protect our own communities and our own neighbors, but we need to stand up to protect the people of Cuba and all those who are suffering from the onslaught of this imperialism, this rules-based order that's imposed on us by the rich and powerful who control Washington.
Hey, Greg, let's wrap it up by telling people how to get a hold of the Minnesota Cuba Committee.
Yeah. Okay, so, one, we've got the Minnesota Cuban Film Festival coming up. We are asking people to come every Wednesday starting March 4th for some great Cuban films to show how the culture of Cuba has portrayed the struggle of human lives, not only in Cuba, but similar to what people are going on around the world. It'll be at the main cinema on the historic waterfront, starting March 4th through April 1st, at at 7 o'clock every Wednesday. So we're asking people to come there, join us for some great movies and super Q&A and discussions about not only the events in Cuba, but how it relates to Minnesota and our struggle here for peace and justice. Also, I'd like you to go to Facebook. Our Facebook sites are Minnesota Cuba Committee, as well as the Minnesota Cuban Film Festival, to get the latest updates and links to ways that you can donate money to help raise funds for humanitarian aid and solar panels to be sent to Cuba. We're doing that right now. And of course, take a trip to Cuba yourself with one of our solidarity trips. I highly recommend the May Day trip. I was on it last summer, and we were able to talk with people all throughout the society in all the sectors that make Cuba function. And you're going to come away with being totally blown away by how they've evolved into such a humane society.
Yes, my guest last week, Ann Wright, said, oh, yeah, it's quite possible to travel to Cuba. So it's don't rule it out if that's your inkling.
Yep, there's still flights going out of Miami and Cancun. That's the simplest way for Canadians and American people from the United States to get to Cuba right now. But definitely go with the Solidarity Group. And I plan to go actually down there in April and work on food production myself.
Well, I want to thank you, Greg Clavin, from the Minnesota Cuba Committee, for coming on and doing all this work over the years to try and alert people to what's really going on in Cuba. Thank you very much for coming in today.
Thank you, Don. Thank you, David.
Now we have a little bit of another topic to deal with. We got on tape John Mearsheimer, who's a political science distinguished professor from the University of Chicago. He was on the Judging Freedom show, How Trump Has Boxed Himself in a Corner on Iran. And this was posted on Tuesday.
The situation in Iran, what can Trump possibly hope to achieve diplomatically?
Well, you know, I've been thinking about this in anticipation of the show. I think if it was just the United States, just Trump and the Iranians, you could work out a deal. I think that you could get some new variant of the JCPOA that could be dressed up as a great improvement on that. And I think the United States could live with some nuclear enrichment capability on the part of the Iranians. And then the Iranians are floating all sorts of proposals that have an economic dimension, how the United States and Iran can get rich together and so forth and so on, that would, I think, be attractive to President Trump. And Trump, I don't think, is enthusiastic about starting another forever war in Iran. So I think if it's just the United States and Iran, you could work out a deal. And by the way, as you like to say, and I agree 100% with what you say, Iran does not present a threat to the United States. That's the starting point. It's not a threat to the United States. So you ought to be able to work out a deal. But the problem here is it's not just the United States, or it's just not the Trump administration and the Iranians. It's the Israelis as well. And the Israelis have a set of demands that go well beyond putting limits on the nuclear enrichment capability. And there's no way the Iranians are ever going to agree to those Israeli demands.
Is the Iranian set of negotiations also a kabuki dance?
Yeah, there's just no question about it. I see no way you're going to work that one out.
Well, do you think that Trump has decided already whether or not he's going to attack, whether it's to please Netanyahu, to please the lobby in the United States or because he honestly thinks this will bring about a resolution to whatever?
I don't know what he's thinking. I mean, I think that he's really boxed himself in here. The problem is it's virtually impossible for any president, including Donald Trump, to ignore what Israel wants. And Israel wants zero enrichment capability. They want the whole nuclear enrichment infrastructure taken down. They want Iran to eliminate all the ballistic missiles it has that can hit Israel. They want Iran to give up supporting the Houthis, Hezbollah, and Hamas. These are demands that there's no way the Iranians are going to accept. So even if Trump can work out a deal that's satisfactory to him along the lines I described before, it's not going to satisfy the Israelis. And the Israelis have made it very clear that they will attack Iran alone if that is necessary. And of course, if they attack Iran, there's no way we don't get involved because we're going to then have to help defend Israel when the Iranians start launching ballistic missiles at Israel. And also, we're going to get involved because the Iranians are, in all likelihood, going to try to shut down the Straits of Hormuz and stop the flow of oil out of the Persian Gulf. So I don't see what Trump can do. And just to take it a step further, as you and I have talked about, he can attack, you know, Trump can have U.S. forces attack Iran, but that doesn't solve the problem. It's not going to get rid of the ballistic missiles. It's not going to cause regime change. It's not going to end Iranian support for Hezbollah, the Houthis, and Hamas. So we don't have a military option here.
I've asked this before. Why is it that Iran, which has signed the non-nuclear proliferation treaty, is not permitted to have a nuclear weapon, and Israel, which has not signed that treaty, is permitted to have a nuclear weapon? Can anybody explain that?
Yeah, I can explain it to you. It's very simple. Israel has a special relationship with the United States that has no parallel in history. Israel can do pretty much anything it wants, and we will give it unconditional support. With regard to all the countries that live in Israel's neighborhood, Israel basically dictates to us that we have to go to enormous lengths to make sure they have no nuclear weapons of their own, or even a nuclear enrichment capability, as we have been talking about, and that those countries kowtow to Israel. And we go to great lengths to help Israel achieve those goals. That's what's going on here. You just have to understand that there's a special relationship here between the United States and Israel that has no parallel in recorded history.
Here, this is just in from the Hindustan Times about 30 minutes ago. Iran has sent shockwaves through global markets by declaring a round-the-clock surveillance lockdown over the Strait of Hormuz, a vital choke point carrying nearly one-fifth of the world's daily oil flow. The IRGC Navy, that's the Iranian Navy, announced full spectrum monitoring across surface vessels, drones, even submarines during intense naval drills in and around the Straits of Hormuz. So the Chinese import 1.4 million barrels of oil from Iran a day. Are they just going to sit back and allow the Iranian leadership to be toppled if Netanyahu and Trump attack?
No, they're going to go to great lengths to help Iran. And as I said to you before, with the passage of time, the Chinese especially, but also the Russians, are going to help the Iranians more and more. And that's why I said to you a year from now when we're talking about this issue, right, it will be clear that the China-Russia dimension will be more important then than it is now. But it's already important now. I want to make one other quick point to you, just to put this whole crisis in perspective. I believe that virtually every country in the Middle East, except maybe the UAE, which is pretty closely allied with Israel, but virtually every other country in the Middle East, plus the Chinese, plus the Russians, want this war to not happen. The only country that really wants it to happen is Israel. As we've talked about, the Americans really don't want this war. Trump doesn't want to fight a war against Iran. He's being pushed down this road by the Israelis. So you see the remarkable power of Israel simply because it has such a hold over American policymakers. Just think about it. Every country in the Middle East, except maybe the UAE, is desperate to avoid this war. The Chinese and the Russians don't want this war. Trump really doesn't want this war. Who wants this war? Benjamin Netanyahu.
Well, will he get the war that he wants?
Boy, it's very hard to say. I go back and forth on this one. On one hand, I say, this war can't happen because we can't achieve our goals by striking Iran. And furthermore, you have to take into account what Iran can do in retaliation. You were just talking about the Straits of Hormuz and what the consequences would be if that one heated up. And of course, the Iranians are going to launch ballistic missiles at Israel as well. So it's hard to see why it makes sense to start this war from a purely strategic point of view.
That was John Mearsheimer on Judge Napolitano's Judging Freedom, and that was posted on February 17th.
So one question there resulting from Mearsheimer's comments is whether, in fact, we actually have rational actors leading this thing, and it's not clear that we do. The president certainly doesn't convey or demonstrate a lot of rational behavior, and also the president isn't necessarily in charge. I hate to break it to you in case you think otherwise, but there's a tremendous momentum for war, and it benefits the military-industrial to have war, whether or not it leads to any kind of victory. 20 years of school, and then they put you in a day shift. 20 years of war in Afghanistan was tremendously profitable for the military-industrial. So this whole business is used to keep up the excitement and keep them going, and war is in their interest. So Israel, I think, repeating Mearsheimer's warning, has a tremendous evil grip on what's going on in this country. And the question is, pointing out again one thing that was said there, is whether if Trump and the war planners here actually understand that it's not in their interest to start a war with Iran, Israel may do it anyway and then draw us into it. That's how nefarious their influence is in this whole situation. So we're going to have a big reckoning in this country over the role of Israel.
So the United States has sent two carrier groups to the area, the one that they took out of the area around Venezuela. I believe it now is in position, but there's not an unlimited amount of armaments, even so, for the U.S. to be fighting in these kind of missile and drone events. Because it's just not something that they are set up to industrial make as many as it could be used. And so it wouldn't last very long, but Iran keeps making more and more. And that's why Netanyahu says, well, it's got to be on the nuclear possibility of weapons and on their missiles. Because they did have a lot of missiles that made it through the Iron Dome and back.
Limitations of the U.S. military power are becoming more and more evident, and that is also coming into the argument with regard to a war in Iran. As Don just mentioned, we can only last at the level of anticipated missiles for a couple of weeks, but the pressure's on. I think the war makers and the Israel backers see their window of opportunity narrowing here, with Russia and China coming in more and more to help militarily, technically, and other ways. And they're doing military exercises there now with Iran and Russia and China coming in a few days. So you know, we have the threat of undeclared atomic power and out-of-control nationalistic fervor in Israel that may threaten to use atomic bombs. So this is really serious here. We may be talking about the beginnings of World War III. And since we're just about done, I want to mention two other things, break off a little bit here, and remind people that the great Jesse Jackson, speaking of Israel and Palestine, was a very adamant and outspoken defender of Palestinian rights since the late 1980s. And this isn't mentioned a lot of times in the honorifics for all the other famous things he did, but he was a tremendous defender of the Palestinians for many, many years, and even was condemned for even speaking to Palestinians and things of that sort. So I want to remind people that that was part of Jesse Jackson's legacy.
Yeah, he was a good friend of Fidel's and defended the Cuban Revolution because he knew that the Cubans came to the aid of the Black Liberation Movement and the Civil Rights Movement in the 1960s and 70s. By taking in the freedom fighters that were persecuted and attacked by our government.
A lot of these things, it makes you wonder, I mean, how much pressure the U.S. can put around. Well, look, I'm Mexico and all these other countries of the world to not do anything which Uncle Sammy doesn't want. It's who calls the tune, but who makes the money has been very well established. Dave, you have?
Yeah, I'd like to sneak in a reminder to the listeners that we need some help for the future of this program, and we're looking for younger folks with interest in politics and radio that can easily learn the ropes here and continue the Northern Sun News with alternative discussion of political events, something that's needed as much as ever in this country. So if you're interested, Don and I will get back to you. Just send to my email. It's a simple Gmail address, DaveGCoop, DaveGCoop, DaveGCoop@gmail.com, and just indicate some interest in Northern Sun News. And hope to hear from you. Thanks.
Good. That was Dave Gudnick. And this is Don Olson. And Greg Clavey is just finishing up here, too. And so it's hope you do stay here all afternoon. And
welcome to MN90, Minnesota History in 90 Seconds.
1905. The chief engineer overseeing the construction of the Panama Canal resigned in frustration. The French had failed to build the canal. Now it looked like the Americans would too when John Stevens, the replacement chief engineer, arrived. He spent the past couple decades as a Minneapolis surveyor and an engineer for St. Paul Railroad magnate James J. Hill. But what he found in Panama went beyond depressing. The canal was in a devil of a mess. He told the Washington bureaucrats he would work on the canal until it was clear whether it would succeed or fail. For 2 years, Stevens clomped about in rubber boots and overalls and hat, simply tidying up the infrastructure to get supplies to the site and men fed, sheltered, and doctored. And when it was certain the project would go forward, John Stevens handed in his resignation so his successors could complete the Panama Canal, which opened in 1914.
MN90 is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund, online at mn90.org.
Okay, I'm over here at just a minute before 2 o'clock. You are listening to Fresh Air Community Radio KFAI 90.3 FM, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and around the world at kfai.org. Support for Fresh Air Community Radio comes from KFAI listeners, members, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Okay, my program here is Global Beat, and I'm proud of it, and my partner, Deborah, and...
Hello, all you Global Beat KFAI listeners out there. It's a beautiful day. The ice is melting, and it's not too slippery yet. Lots of sunshine, too. I hope you enjoy the show today.